This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Even though Jane Austen wrote her novels more than 150 years ago, today's filmmakers are discovering the cinematic possibilities in her fiction. We've seen recent adaptations of Sense and Sensibility, Persuasion, and an offbeat modern take on Emma called Clueless, set in Beverly Hills. Douglas McGrath has just made the latest Jane Austen film adaptation, a more faithful rendering of Emma, starring Gwyneth Paltrow in the title role. Emma is a well-to-do 21-year-old who has made it her life's work to play matchmaker to the residents of her small English town. She successfully got her nanny married off and determines to do the same thing for a good friend.
She was as selfless a friend as I have ever had. And I hope to say someday I have done half as much for someone as Mrs. Weston did for me.
You must be happy that she settled so well.
Indeed. One matter of joy in this is that I made the match myself. People said Mr. Weston would never marry again, and what a triumph!
Triumph? You made a lucky guess.
Have you never known the triumph of a lucky guess? Had I not promoted Mr. Weston's visits and given encouragement where encouragement was needed, we might not have had a wedding today.
Then please, my dear, encourage no one else. Marriage is so disrupting to one's social circle.
Only one more, Papa. When Mr. Elton joined their hands today, he looked very much as if he would like the same kind office performed for him.
Problem is, Emma is a lousy matchmaker. Douglas McGrath makes his directorial debut with Emma. He also wrote the screenplay. McGrath collaborated with Woody Allen a few years back on the screenplay for Bullets Over Broadway. He's a contributing editor of The New Republic, where he writes a satirical column about a Secret Service agent hired to protect President Clinton called The Flapjack File. I asked McGrath why he wanted to make his first movie based on Emma.
When I first read it, it reminded me of those great comedies that Hollywood used to make in the 30s and 40s. Most particularly, it reminds me of The Philadelphia Story. And it has that kind of, I mean, there are many similarities in a way. You know, both Emma and The Philadelphia Story have extremely attractive heroines who are witty and well-spoken, who are surround themselves or live in a world full of other witty, well-spoken people, most of whom are making a complete mess of their lives. And it takes the two heroines, it takes falling in love for them to become better, more compassionate people. And it's so rare that you can go to the movies these days and see a literate comedy. And I really wanted to try to write a literate comedy. And Emma has all those ingredients.
What was it like for you then to take this novel, which you obviously connected to, and try to turn it into a screenplay? Because obviously you have to make some pretty hard choices about what you're going to keep, what you're going to discard.
Mm-hmm, that's true. That's the hardest part in a way, is allowing yourself to leave something out. Because the book is so exquisitely written, you don't really want to take anything out. But, you know, you'd have a 9-hour movie if you didn't take some things out. So what I did was I made an outline. At the top of every page of the book, I would write very briefly what happened on that page. And by the end of the book, I took everything that I had written and made it into an outline, which ran to be about 40 or 50 pages. And then what you do is you just look for places where there might be repetition and where you could stand to compress some things. And eventually you get it, you know, boiled down, for want of a more felicitous phrase, into the essence of the novel. And luckily, the way she tells the story works quite naturally for the movies. It's all spoken out loud between the characters, so you don't have to find a way to get the story across that isn't already there.
And the dialogue that we hear in the movie, is that really lifted right from the novel?
It's my policy to lift as much pre-written dialogue as possible. Every so often, I was forced to fall back on my own resources and write something of my own. But it was my policy to take as much as possible. And you would want to anyway, apart from my natural laziness, you would want to, because she's, not to trivialize it quite as much as it sounds like, but she's one of the great dialogue writers of all time.
Well, it is one of the more talky films I think I've seen in recent times, where it seems that almost every moment of the film, people are talking about something.
Well, that is true. But that's, you know, that's what they had then. They, you know, no one was going to the the Cineplex, the Cineplex 5, and no one was getting a lovely show like this, and no one, I mean, you know, their opportunities for entertainment rested, apart from books, on discussion and conversation, and the gossip that they had about the lives of the people in their town.
Did you see the movie Clueless, which is a very modern update of this Jane Austen novel, Emma?
Yes, I did.
What did you think of it?
I thought it was delightful. I was actually very worried about it before I went because I knew it was taken from the same material. But when I saw it, it was so, you know, delightfully its own piece, and it's very, very loosely, well, highly loosely based on Emma, so that you don't really feel that the material and the story has been exhausted by their approach to it.
And you weren't concerned that Clueless would steal your thunder?
Well, I was concerned about everything.
Okay.
But that's my general policy. But once I saw it, I don't know, for some reason it seemed different enough. In a way, it widens the audience for Emma, because when you see Clueless and see how delightful it is, you couldn't possibly think that the original author of that story could be anything but a person of great entertainment, you know, and someone who's a lot of fun.
Well, there's something you said about your approaching this film, which I found really interesting, which was you wanted to play this comedy like a tragedy. And certainly when you look at the lives of these people, they spend a great amount of time worried about things as inane as a chipped teacup. But how does tragedy, at least the way you wanted to deal with this film, how does tragedy enhance the comedy?
Well, you know, if you play the least little thing in there, you know, nothing tragic happens in the film. But if they treat everything with the importance of tragedy, if they treat a snub at a dance or an insult at a party as if it's the most important thing in the world, that makes it more amusing to us, because you see how hilariously important the most trivial thing is to them. And there's a scene in particular in which I always think of this. Harriet Smith, who is Emma's the young woman that Emma's taken under her wing, Emma thinks to help, but as we see, whose lives she ruins. Harriet has been in love with Mr. Elton, this vicar, who is not in love with her. And she has saved these little mementos that have the vaguest connection to Mr. Elton, a little piece of bandage that he touched once and a pencil that he left in their house. And she keeps them in a bag called Harriet Smith's Most Precious Treasures. And she guards them and holds them with such delicacy, and as if they are, you know, valuable jewels. And the fact that she so sincerely, so deeply has so much feeling for them, if she treated them lightly, it wouldn't be funny to us.
You attended a White House screening of Emma, I believe sat right next to the president.
Mm-hmm.
In doing so, is it possible to pay attention to what you put on the screen, knowing that the president of the United States is sitting right next to you?
No, it's actually not possible. Luckily, I've seen the film more than 2 million times now, so I don't actually need to pay attention to it. And I was much more interested in watching him. It's amazing how you can get your eye, I never thought you could, to actually change directions, your left eye, which is on the presidential side, from where the right eye is looking. You can keep the right eye on the screen and swing that left one around. You can't pay the least bit of attention. But I might say no one else in the audience can either.
They're all watching the president, too?
They watch the president watch the movie. I think it would be unfair of anyone who was at that screening to say they watched the movie. They would just have to say they watched President Clinton watch the movie, because it was like, you know, there'd be a joke or something funny would happen in the movie, and he would laugh, and then a half second later, the rest of the audience would laugh. And if he didn't laugh, nobody laughed. But it had that weird sense of delay, like on a transatlantic phone call.
Did he talk during the movie? One of my pet peeves in a movie theater.
Yes, he did, and you can't ask him to be quiet. You can't just say, shh, watch the movie. Because he was talking about the movie. He actually asked questions throughout the movie, which was nice. My mother, who talks continuously through every movie we've ever attended, felt so validated to hear that he'd spoken during the movie, because she and I now have to sign a contract before we'll go to the movies with each other, which her behavior is quite limited. But at least his questions were all about the movie. You know, he'd ask where we shot and who was playing certain parts and whether Gwyneth had worked with an accent coach. And he was really very interested in the details of it.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Douglas McGrath, and he just made his directorial debut with the new film Emma, which he adapted from the Jane Austen novel. He also co-wrote the screenplay Two Bullets Over Broadway with Woody Allen, which got an Oscar nomination. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Douglas McGrath, and his new film Emma has just come out. Let's just talk a little bit about your childhood. You grew up in Texas.
I did, in Midland, Texas.
Did you show any early interest in acting and showbiz as a kid?
I did. I think anyone growing up in Midland would turn to their imagination at a fairly young age. There's not a great deal, especially if you don't really want to be involved in a dirt-related activity. There's not a great deal to do. So I was always, writing little plays and carrying on, I'm sure, in horrifying and embarrassing ways to my parents. But, from the beginning.
You attended Princeton University.
I did.
Was that a big leap out of Texas?
Well, I had gone to prep school before that in Connecticut. I'd gone to Choate, Rosemary Hall. And so that was more the big leap. Mm. That was actually quite a shock to my system because everything was different. Princeton seemed, by comparison to my years at prep school, quite easy and friendly because I'd kind of gone through all the hard stuff of leaving home and changing sides of the country at prep school. So Princeton was actually four uninterruptedly happy years. Mm. I thought it was completely delightful. And also, you know, Midland is very, let's just say, not overpopulated with trees and greens. And Princeton is quite lush and beautiful. So I was just happy. You know, I would just be happy looking at it, apart from everything else. I just thought, this is so beautiful. I can't believe it.
Well, after you graduated from Princeton, shortly after you graduated, you did get a job with Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. And this was the fateful season 1980 to 1981, considered perhaps the worst season in mm-hmm. Saturday Night Live. What were you hired to do?
It seems to help ruin the show. I was hired as a writer, which was the equivalent of helping to ruin the show. It's funny because I didn't have any plan for what I was going to do when I got out of college. And I knew I wanted to be an actor or a writer or something, but I didn't know how I was going to make a living at it. And I was so paralyzed with fright about it, that about how to go about making a living and paying for an apartment and taking care of myself, that it was so unnerving to me that I just decided not to do anything and hope somehow somebody gave me a job out of pity.
And they did.
And it worked. I don't know how this happened, but the day before graduation, my old friend from Midland, Liz Welch, who now lived in New York, was working at the show, and she said, they're hiring new writers. You should send in some material, because I'd written some plays in college. And so I sent in some material, and I got hired. And I thought, oh, this is fabulous, because at that point, Jane Curtin and Gilda Radner and Bill Murray and all those great people were on the show. So I thought, hey, this is great. Little did I realize that, you know, the reason they were hiring people of my caliber is that every single writer on the show had quit. All the actors had quit. Everybody, the guy who puts the water in the water cooler had quit. There were 125 empty desks in that office, and they needed people to fill it. So I was the first writer hired, which I thought was a compliment, but then I later saw it was an omen. And, like 17 others were hired. A new cast. This is when Eddie Murphy started. And he was the best of the group.
Sure.
But then there was a drop-off after that. And it was really, really a terrible year.
Well,
because of us, really. Because the writing was very, very bad that year.
So where did you go after Saturday Night Live?
To my room, back to my room. And I wrote some screenplays with, one screenplay with a very funny writer from the show named Terry Sweeney, which we sold on the verge of our bankruptcy to Paramount, and which was never made, but was rewritten by, I don't know if you rewrote it, but it seemed to have been rewritten by every other person in the country. And then I wrote a screenplay on my own, and the exact same thing happened. Sold it to Disney, and then they didn't make it. And then I just thought, I don't want to do this. Because it was too discouraging to work that way.
Well, what I read was that after realizing that a number of screenplays that never went anywhere, and I think one called Born Yesterday, which was pretty much a failure, that you went back to fiction, went back to reading, and decided perhaps in order to learn this craft, I have to go back to the masters and figure out how to tell a good story.
Yeah. Well, the reading is the best thing. It wasn't quite as conscious as that, but reading was the best thing. Reading great books was the best thing I could have ever done because the quality of the writing in those books is so great at every level. It's not just good narrative and it's not just good characters. It's also good dialogue. It's also poetic. The classics are classics because they're really great at every level. And I think one of the risks for screenwriters today, or one of the mistakes young screenwriters make, is that they study other movies. And that's why you feel when you go to a movie so often these days, it just feels like other movies. It feels derivative of things that aren't particularly meaningful to the writer. And I found that in reading great books, you learn so many things that are helpful in a movie, like how to make a character distinctive and interesting. If you look at Emma, for instance, most movies that come out today the lead might be attractive, the co-star might be attractive, possibly there's one supporting part. You might have three parts that are interesting. But in Emma, Austin writes easily five great characters, possibly six, seven, eight great characters. And that's such a great thing to learn as a writer. And you look at great literature, that's true in all the books. Not to mention the narrative strength that they bring. So that was really helpful to me.
You did collaborate with Woody Allen on Bullets Over Broadway, helped actually co-wrote the screenplay with him. And I wonder in person if he is that sort of same nervous, talkative, insightful, but also bumbling person that we see on the screen?
Not really. He's very, actually, very disciplined, very organized. He's very smart about how he knows what he wants to do with his work and how he's going to. I've rarely seen him in any way that wouldn't be described as calm. When we were writing Bullets, it was during the time that he was seeking custody of his children, and that our writing was interrupted many times by phone calls he had to take from his lawyers and strategists. And I was amazed at how he could take those phone calls, deal with what needed to be dealt with, and then come back and go back to work on the script. And he has great focus. There are little things, that are similar, but he is continuously interested in the state of his health. There are things that overlap, but in life, it's not the way it is in the movies. He takes that idea and then he enlarges it so that it becomes, funny for the movie.
Well, Bullets Over Broadway did get an Oscar nomination. He never goes to the Oscars. I believe he tends to go and play at Michael's Pub in New York instead of going. Did you want to go to the Oscars? I mean, this is, of course, the most reviled ceremony that everybody in the world watches.
Not only did I want to go, we went.
Oh, did you?
Well, for a long time, I thought, I can't go to that. Every year I watch and I think, look how grubby those people look going up those stairs to grab that prize. Just sad, 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 sad. And then I was looking around my apartment and I thought, well, it'd be hard to beat this for grubbiness. And so and my wife was, without over-describing it, feverishly interested in going. And I thought, well, we should go see what it's like. And we went and it was just divine because it was every cliche you could have ever hoped for. And if you're going to watch the Oscars, I have to admit, it's a little better to be there than at home because during the 9 hours of commercials and everything that come in between things, when you're watching at home, you get up during the commercials, you try and take some kind of heavily caffeinated beverage to keep you going, slap yourself around, get some medical supplies going. And at the ceremony, when they have the commercial, you can stand up from your seat and look around, and there are heaps, big herds of movie stars all through the room, which, for me, picked the evening up quite a bit.
Well, did you try to stay cool and calm and contain yourself, or were you just goo-goo, gaga over all the celebrities around you?
I'd say goo-goo and gaga would be two of them the best ways to describe it. Luckily, I wasn't nervous about the evening because I didn't expect that we would win. And so I was able to just settle in and enjoy the high celebrity.
Quotient, right?
Yeah, the quotient all around us, just everywhere. Any place you threw a rock, you could hit four or five big stars. And it's fascinating. I like seeing people's real heights and the, you know, the appalling outfits up close. I found delightful in every way. I don't have a single criticism of it. And at the parties afterwards, all the food, shaped like Oscars.
Right?
Everything you could have dreamed. It was just wonderful.
Well, Douglas McGrath, I thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you, too. Enjoyed it.
Douglas McGrath wrote the screenplay for and directed the new film Emma. This fall, he's performing in an off-Broadway play he wrote called Political Animal. This is Fresh Air.